Thank you.
Open this committee of the House Veterans and Emergency Services on March 31st. Important day, my granddaughter's birthday.
Yay.
And I will open a public hearing and a possible work session on House Bill 2165. General Caldwell, Mr. Evans, or as I referred to you earlier as the usual suspects.
I thought they were the dynamic duo.
Oh, excuse me, that's probably much more polite.
You want to start? You want me to? Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. House Bill 2165 is, and I think we have an amendment to our, you want to start with Mr. DeVito?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I neglected my assistant, able assistant here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2165 would allow a member of the Oregon National Guard who is trained and certified by the Armed Forces of the United States to administer health care services in an emergency. We do have a dash one to this we should have before you, which, bottom line, it authorizes a member of the Oregon National Guard on active state duty or Title 32 orders who are trained and certified by the armed forces to administer health care services in a governor-declared state of emergency or a public health emergency without being subject to the Oregon licensing requirements for health care providers. This does not carry a fiscal or a revenue impact, and we do have the dash ones before us.
Thank you, Mr. Molina. I think my understanding on this was it was a swell idea, and then when the legal departments in everybody's respective areas got a hold of it, we had to write an amendment for it. What a surprise. So if you could kind of bring us up to date.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think, in essence, you've explained the bill. I think the issue here is primarily we have some homework to do to try to work with the licensing agencies to crosswalk the training that our members get through the military that is certifiable in any academic environment in America, and that's the next step. However, during an emergency, we know these people have these certifications. They're completely able and willing. It's just that we don't want to put them in a box and not be able to use them during a governor-declared emergency, and that's simply what this does. I think the next step will be to work those licensing issues and get dual licensing, and that's where we want to be. I think that helps our people. That will also allow them an opportunity to compete for employment opportunities that may exist in that particular, particularly the EMT business. These are trained medics. They're skilled people, and so I think this is a good step, and I think this will do what we want to do to bridge that gap or bridge that situation until we can get that licensing thing all married up. That concludes my testimony. Pending any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Evans. I'm policy advisor to Governor Kulongoski for emergency management and veterans issues. Very brief comments today. Just want to emphasize that especially with the current economic conditions going on, a lot of local areas are not going to have the same capacity that maybe they've had for some time. And the ability to use the National Guard resources at our disposal in those events large enough to warrant a declaration are essential. And that this bill will go a long way to helping make sure and take that first step in lining things up between those that have been trained to provide care and the current statutory responsibilities. During a governor's declared emergency, we simply just need to use all the capacity that's in the toolbox, and that's what this bill will do. So if I have any questions, I'll try to answer, and thank you for considering the bill.
Thank you. And thank you for working out any of the issues that we had with it. Are there any questions for these gentlemen? Seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who is here today that wanted to speak to House Bill 2165? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2165, assuming the committee is comfortable with that.
Could I take yours?
No.
We need to, first of all, add the dash one amendments. Representative Matthews?
Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion. We'd move the Dash Warrant Amendments to House Bill 2165.
Thank you. We have a motion to move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2165. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Aye.
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 Riley? Aye.
Freeman?
Aye.
Matthews?
Aye.
Sir Callan?
Aye. We have approved the addition of Dash 1 amendments, and I guess are ready.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we would move 2165 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
We have a motion to bring House Bill 2165 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Oh. Let me try that one more time. We have before us an amendment to move forward House Bill 2165 as amended with the subsequent referral to health care by prior notice. Was that your motion, Representative Matthews?
That was my motion, Madam
Chair. That's what I thought.
Sure, that's what he said.
Okay, thank you. Could we call the roll on that one then?
Aye.
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 Riley?
Aye.
Wagner?
Aye.
Freeman?
Aye.
Matthews?
Aye.
And Chair
Collins? Aye. I apologize. I overlooked that subsequent referral, so we will move this one forward to health care. Oops. And now I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2167. I'm just going to let whoever wants to come up, come up.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2167 would allow the Office of Emergency Management, OEM, its agencies to request, disperse, and make payments at the beginning of the first quarter from its Emergency Communications Account, ECA, instead of at the end of the quarter and be reimbursed. It's a timing modifications bill. And it has no amendments, no fiscal revenue impact.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, a division of the Oregon Military Department. You had heard this bill, seems like a long, long time ago, and we had some subsequent discussions about it, and we resolved those, and now it's back up. And this is really, as Mr. Molina explained, streamlining the process of how the money is used in our account in the proper quarter so that we're spending appropriately and managing the money better. And this will make our office and the process fiscally correct and more responsible in the way we manage the money and using it in the same quarter. So without belaboring that anymore, that's all that I would have unless there's any questions.
Representative Kump.
Chair, thank you. Chair Cowan. Just because I'm becoming, I am a novice in ways and means, but can you describe your communication with Department of Administrative Services on this, or have you had it, or what recommendations have they given you in this process?
Madam Chair and Representative Kump, I have not had any conversations with them. Most of my conversations on this particular process would be with the fiscal accounting staff at the Oregon Military Department, so I have not talked to DAS about it.
Okay. Yes, please. And it's just that you might cover that base before it comes before the committee. It's just that it seems like DAS is a real important entity to
Madam
review
Chair,
the process.
Madam Chair, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department, who did vet all of these with DAS. It was introduced by the
Thank
governor,
you.
And we went through a process at the department to show them everything that we were attempting to do, and they had no comments on this particular bill.
Perfect.
So,
thank you. Any other questions? General, did you have anything else you wanted to put in on this?
Drive on.
Okay. I am going to close the public hearing on 2167, and I am going to hold it for later in today's meeting for a possible work session. which will become clear, my reasoning, in a little bit. I hope. With that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2460. Mr. Molina.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2460 expands definition of a rural area for the purpose of expanding the emergency medical technician EMT tax credit. It takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment, sine die.
Thank you.
This does have, excuse me,
has
two amendments.
We have a dash one and a dash three.
Yes.
Did we lose dash two? Or?
No, the dash
okay.
two, I don't have. It's just dash one and dash okay. three, so I apologize.
We're working dash one and dash,
dash
three.
One amendment. It doubles the tax credit from $250 to $500 per year. It removes the 2001 sunset provision, making the tax credit permanent. The dash three, what that does, it entirely removes the in bold, the county provision of 75,000 or more residents. That was been removed, and it increases the population provision from 30,000 to 40,000. To my understanding, to more closely align with the Office of Rural Health definition for rural, they use 40,000. So those are the two major amendments, and we do have a fiscal on this, as expected. The current tax credit is estimated to cost roughly $300,000 per biennium and is scheduled to sunset on January 1st, 2011. Of course, I just got to make note here about the sunset provision. A little bit of a discussion with our policy committee on revenue. There is something in the move over on that end to put a sunset on anything that has an impact on revenue. Just as a side note there, and I can get more information as we proceed.
I believe Representative Maurer has joined us. Ah, there you are. See what happens when I try to read notes and look at the same time. And it's for this bill, am I correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Please join us.
Madam
Thank
Chair,
you.
I intend to testify on this too. May I go in?
Would you like to join Representative Maurer?
Yeah, if he agrees.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
You're always welcome.
You go first.
Madam Chair, Representative Ron Maurer, serving House District 3, which is most of Josephine County. And this, we had a short conversation a while ago, and there's an amendment. I think the amendment is very helpful. The issue for me started in a small town of Glendale, which is not my district, but just barely north, very, very rural area in a mountainous area along the I-5 corridor. And the old law excluded Glendale, and it is can be, I would say, treacherous, but a long distance to the closest hospital and in foul weather can be treacherous. And the issue is a small community like Glendale of not very many people is relying upon itself to take care of itself. And the community saw this tax credit as a way that would help them keep volunteers. And I looked at the issue and said, boy, this is something that we need in rural communities. Because we do, quite frankly, rely on volunteers for much of what most of the urban areas just expect as something that's just part of daily business, daily life. Clearly, the fiscal is going to be an issue. But this is a policy committee, and you get to make policy decisions. And this is, in fact, good public policy. Urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. I say Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, the beautiful upper left coast. I joined the fire department, Hamlet Volunteer Rural Fire Department, in 1990. As a result of having experienced 11 head-on MVAs in front of our home and being the first person on scene and not knowing what to do. Subsequently, and we moved there in 74, so quite a few up to that point. Subsequently, I took the classes, the training, and attended drills every week at my own cost, like everyone else in the rural fire departments usually do, and which runs several hundred dollars. The classes are 10-week classes at the community college, which is an hour drive each way for 3 hours, three times a week, two times a week, whatever they run it. And with small children in the house, and my husband is the chief of the department. So we're a volunteer fire department family, as are many in our family. And when my son and daughter became old enough, they both joined. My son stayed on a little bit longer till he moved away. In my district and in many of your rural districts, you find mostly volunteer departments. They may have a paid chief. They often don't. Most of the, I think, two out of mine in my district in Clatsop County are paid. So all that being said, time spent is personal time away from family, away from jobs, because you go, you're on duty 24/7. When the call comes, you go. And you never know how many people will show up. So you might have a 6-vehicle, 12-patient MVA. You might have a school bus overturned. You might have our worst nightmare, a logging accident. And it's way up in the hills, and sometimes you're driving 5-6 miles into the site to dispense the aid. As the Representative Maurer said, these are very rural areas. Help is not close. In most trauma situations, the golden hour is truly the golden half hour. And we stretch it out to 2 sometimes. But the first people on scene to deliver the treatment is crucial, because our ambulance service, because we don't, in my case and in most of the volunteer departments, do not transport unless it's an emergency situation where they don't have enough vehicles for the people. We are using our district's equipment, which we pay for in some cases by a tax base, some cases not, but most often people are out of pocket for all the disposables and their training and their cleaning, and we don't need to get into that, but you can imagine, and gas to and from calls, drills, etc., classes. So this very small tax credit, which you've seen before, those of you who've known me since I've been on this side of the table, for a long time, and we have one now at $250 just for EMS people, but to join, most of the fire departments do both fire and emergency services. This is a very small thing to do, and it's a very good thing we can do. Retention is difficult, as Representative Maurer relayed to you. Even more difficult is attracting new members. Average age of volunteer firefighters in Oregon is running around 50 to 55 years. It's kind of hard to believe, and I'm older than that. So a lot of our people are older, and we're trying to get some younger people to join. You're ending up with people with small children, et cetera. It's a lot to ask. So this is something we can do to make this it's not like any, and I've heard this argument too, then you're going to have to pay all the volunteers, but it's not like every volunteer. If you volunteer in a hospital or at a library or with a school group or something, usually you don't have a lot of out-of-pocket expenses and a lot of time expended. So this is a very small thing we can do to keep our volunteers in our rural areas who do provide the first response. And a lot of the people, I tell people when they come to the beach from Portland to my beaches in Clatsop County, they're going through 5 rural departments before they get to Seaside or Cannon Beach or Gerhard, wherever they're headed. And they all are volunteer. They're all just, your neighbors, your friends, et cetera. And they all are very, very dedicated to this. And we take good care of the people that we end up caring for on the street. So I hope you will give this your positive consideration. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions for these two? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The only thing that bothers me about this whole thing is in a county with a population of fewer than 75,000.
I think that's
a pretty
changed.
Small county. And
go ahead.
Pardon?
There's an amendment before us reducing that to 40,000.
Well, I don't have that amendment.
Dash 3.
Madam
Chair, Representative Esquivel, the amendment actually eliminates the county size and says 25 miles from a town larger than Medford. So within our area, Representative Esquivel, that would mean Medford. If you are further than 25 miles from Medford, then you would be eligible for the tax credit, as I understand it. Currently, Grants Pass, 25 miles from Grants Pass is excluded because it was 30,000, if I'm not mistaken. And so this expands the universe pretty substantially. And what I was going to say or add to what Representative Boone said was on the I-5 corridor is heavily traveled. And there's a stretch of highway south of Canyonville and north of Grants Pass, about Sexton Summit, and I'm not quite sure where Glendale starts and stops their service. But there's a stretch of I-5 that is heavily traveled that if you have an accident out there, there are a lot of deer, there are a few elk, but a lot of deer, and some nasty curves, and you have an accident out there, it's usually going to be a state trooper. The next car behind you is probably the first person. The second person is going to be a state trooper. And it's very likely if there's an injury, it's going to be somebody from Glendale. And even more likely, it's going to be a volunteer. And, you know, when we drive our highways, especially our interstate highways, I think we expect paid people to come to our assistance. The reality is it's not. And Representative Moon made the comment, you're driving through five volunteer districts, and this is a...
For 35 miles.
For 35 miles. This is a small price to pay for people that are doing this out of the goodness of their heart.
And I wanted to add, too, that I reflected the training level for my first responder, which is the lowest level of training. We have people who are EMTs. We used to be ones and twos. It's basics and intermediates, and then paramedics. And some departments have at least one paramedic on their department, and the rest are EMTs. This is additional training, and it's state-sanctioned, state-licensed training that you have to keep up so many hours, 16 hours a year, I think, to add to what your basic level has been up to that. Each level, you have to keep that up in order to maintain that level of training. And when you consider that if you do have the unfortunate event of a very bad crash and anything's at 55, if anybody's actually going 55, they never are, but you know that when two cars hit at 55 miles an hour, your actual hit volume is 110. And this is trauma. This is heavy trauma. And as Representative Matthews probably seen a lot of that in Portland, and logging accidents are all trauma. There is no minimum level logging accident. Those guys don't even call you. And that at that point, we're talking about getting helicopters in, et cetera. But we're usually transporting these people out of the woods, and it's anywhere from 2 to 10, 20 miles on those logging roads. Somebody has to stabilize them in the first place, and that's the first responders, people who show up from these departments.
Thank you. I want to clarify. I may have misstated earlier. The Dash 3 amendments leave the 75,000 alone, so it still reads in a county with a population of fewer than 75,000, or at least 25 miles from a city with a population of, and that's where it changes it to 40,000. I think I slipped a line on a number. I'd Representative Riley, and then we'll come back to.
I never got to ask my question.
Excuse me, one moment. Let us get this question asked.
I mean, I never did. I get it. What I was going to ask was, in a county with a population of fewer than 75,000 or at least 25 miles from a city with a population of 40,000 or more, why did we insert the population of fewer than 75,000 if we have the catch with a city of 40,000 or more?
Madam Chair.
That was going to be my question.
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, there are experts in the back of this room, and I can think of one, Scott Ekblad, who probably has an answer. I'm not going to even turn around.
Who is our next presenter,
right,
actually?
And who is,
maybe you can hold your question.
Okay, I'm going to hold my question again.
Thank you. Representative Riley, did you have something for these two individuals?
I have a sort of a question, but it's more of a comment, and that is, this is a really good bill with one little exception. And that exception is something I've been working on for 6 years, and that is to make sure that all credits, no matter how good, have sunsets. And this one, this amendment removes the sunset. And sitting on revenue, I can tell you that the policy of our chair is to not let any credit out without a sunset. So I would recommend that that amendment be reworked.
May I add something on that, too?
Well, this, sure. I mean, whoever, I think...
There is existing a bill that allows a $250 tax credit for EMS workers that sunsets, I believe, in December of 2010. So this would...
Extend it.
Yeah, extend it, or this would roll over so that there's no break there.
But my understanding, excuse me, Madam Chair, may I?
You may, because actually I'm trying to figure out what this amendment says.
My understanding of this amendment is, the staff said was that this removes the sunset. And if that is the case, my recommendation is that that be reworked and extend the sunset as opposed to remove it.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Rye, I think your point is noted, and I would clearly have an additional amendment that would apply a sunset, and I probably would put it out at least 6 years, 2018, or
not a problem.
Not a problem. But that, I mean, I think the tax credit sunsets are an issue, and these things do need to be revisited periodically.
Thank you.
We will go ahead and get testimony from the other individuals, but perhaps if we need to take this back, we could get one amendment that rolls all of the pertinent pieces.
Is that the technical term?
I think, first of all, though, what I would like to do is briefly recess the public hearing on House Bill 2460 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3087 to accommodate Representative Edwards, who is in another committee and trying to manage his schedule as well. Welcome.
Well, I appreciate that, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Edwards. I'm state representative from House District 14, serving West Eugene, Santa Clara, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador. House Bill 3087, quite simply, is a tax credit bill for volunteer firefighters. Currently, as you're aware, there is a $250 tax credit for volunteer EMT folks. But in a meeting with my local Lane Rural Fire and Rescue, I came to learn this last summer something that I was not previously aware of, and that is that there is no type of tax credit to help folks out that serve on a volunteer fire department. The Dash 1 amendments, and I'll mention those real briefly before I get into exactly the breadth of the bill. The Dash 1 amendments remove the requirement that the $250 tax credit would apply only to rural volunteer firefighters as defined by serving an area 25 miles or more from an urban center. And the reason I am interested in doing that is because if you look in the Willamette Valley, it is hard to find a place that is more than 25 miles from an area. Yet there are many volunteer fire departments. So, real briefly, entry-level or folks, volunteers, have extensive training, an entry-level firefighter academy, which involves 48 hours of basic firefighting skills, 16 hours of hazardous materials training, and 16 hours of wildland firefighting training. In addition to that, Lane Rural Fire and Rescue adds another 25 more hours of required training to bring the grand total to 105 hours. In addition to that, there are training maintenance standards that are required. As I've said, the state already grants a $250 tax credit to EMTs that operate in rural areas. And after discussion with my rural fire board, who does not serve just in a rural area, but is very much in a kind of in-between spot, serving in unincorporated Lane County, but it's not more than 25 miles from the city of Eugene. And I very much encourage the passage of this bill to extend a $250 tax credit to those folks as well, because they have these costs and this dedication of time that I've spoken of. I understand the budget difficulties as well as any of you do that we face this session, and I recognize that a tax credit is taxes not paid to the state of Oregon. But in a time when volunteerism is down and it is just simply financially impractical to turn these volunteer departments into professional departments, and I say it's just impractical in some of these areas, it would be a $4.5 million cost to the taxpayers in Lane Rural and Fire Rescue's territory. I think, you know, a $250 tax credit to extend some nominal benefit to these folks who serve their community with distinction and honor and commitment, I think is the least we could do. So with that, I'm happy to take questions. Chief Borland was not able to be here from Lane Rural and Fire and Rescue to testify with me, but he has sent some notes with me, and he's probably watching on TV.
Okay, so for clarification, then, with the amendment, this brings it to eligibility for all volunteer firefighters, not rural alone.
Correct.
Okay. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. One, if I may. One is, do you know how many firefighters we're talking about?
That's a good question, Madam Chair, Representative Riley. I don't know statewide. I know in my particular fire district, Lane Rural Fire and Rescue has approximately 15 volunteers. I mean, excuse me, 50. 50 volunteers.
Okay. That's something that I'd like to know. And the other question is for staff. If we pass both of these last two bills, does that mean that we would be covering all of the people all over the state with $500?
This one is set at $250.
Well,
right,
but combined with, if we passed both,
understood.
The question is, would we be covering everybody at $500?
Valid questions.
Right, and that's not a question that I could answer, but I think it was directed to staff.
It was.
So,
right.
And doesn't require an answer,
so
right
looking
now.
Back at staff.
To clarify where we are today, we wanted to get this opened and,
sure.
and heard so that any potential adjustments or amendments could be processed. I believe we also heard in the previous bill, and you were here, that there's some concern if there isn't a sunset on it. So that might be a piece that you would also want to consider.
I've written sunset on my notes, Madam Chair.
And we'll go back to kind of finishing the discussion on the previous one on EMTs. But I do think that there's some logic in thinking through if the committee chooses, and it won't be today, to move these both these bills forward, do we want continuity between the amounts that are suggested for both EMTs and volunteer firefighters? And I know that we have someone from the Small Districts, Special Districts Association here that can maybe help us initially with a few numbers of individuals, but we can follow up and get that. We also have no fiscal at this point on this particular bill before us, and I think part of the reasoning there is that they're asking that we're kind of firm on what final amendments and if we're likely to move a bill before we get that final report. So there are still some considerations. I wanted to get it into the mix for conversation, but you might want to confer with your with those who are writing the other ones and see what you guys can come up with.
I really appreciate that, Madam Chair, and I'd be happy to the extent that there could be a marriage between this and other bills. I'd certainly be happy to work with proponents of other bills. If you'd rather just see one bill, if you want to see two bills, you want to keep them all separate, I'm fine with that as well. I guess my parting thoughts would be that I really hope that this does not break down into one of those fights between volunteers and professionals. And it's certainly not a struggle that I'm interested in seeing. And it was really after visiting with our volunteer folks in Lane Rural Fire and Rescue that I came to understand exactly what their territory looks like, what the services they provide, and just the financial realities and practicality of the options. And so, you know, I really think that this makes a lot of sense, and some of those struggles between professionals and volunteers, I don't think really need to be. I don't think that this is really the territory that needs to be fought over a $250 tax credit. You know, so I thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess being the only career firefighter in the legislature, in legislation, I'll just I'll say that I would agree with you. And basically, from a career versus volunteer, you know, this is one of the battles we don't belong in. I'll just say that when it comes right down to it, and I've said this to several folks in the volunteers, if a firefighter were to pass away today, we'd be all be honoring their commitment and their sacrifice to the community. We'd put a black badge, black tape on our badge, and put a sash on the rig and go to their funeral. So we need to honor them while they're alive as well. So for me, this is not going to be an issue of career firefighter versus volunteers. I think there is probably some reasonable, concern that you would have an EMT that might get, if as amended, $500, then you'd have a firefighter would get another $250. Could somebody get $750? That would be one question somebody might ask that we might be working towards. But I appreciate you bringing it forward, and count on me to help you get through this process. I know it's going to be an uphill battle with revenue, but we'll see where we go. So thanks for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Representative Matthews.
I think just before we temporarily at least close the hearing on this particular one, Representative Edwards, I will tell you that what my inclination at this point is at the finish of the hearings on these two bills, that we try to put together a work group that can take a look at all of the various issues that have been raised and see what the logical conclusion might be. So hopefully you'll be involved with that.
I'd be happy to. I'd love to join the effort, and I thank you for accommodating my schedule. I do need to get back to the committee that Ways and Means Sub.
I think assured that this is a committee that respects the volunteer commitment in all of the emergency services.
Thank you.
As long as I have a gavel in my hand, at least. So thank you very much
for coming.
With that, I will temporarily close the public hearing on 3087 and reopen the public hearing on 2460. We had Scott Ekblad, I believe. Thank you for your patience. Sorry for the small diversion there.
No problem. Chair Cowan, members of the committee, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health. We're the office that administers the current volunteer EMT tax credit, and you're just being handed a map that demonstrates visually the communities. Those are the ones in red that would be added to the tax. In other words, the volunteer EMTs in those communities would be added to the current tax credit program should House Bill 2460 pass. Other than that, I'm here to simply answer questions. I had some pretty thorough testimony the first time this bill was heard. If I could answer the question that was raised earlier about the 75 counties under 75,000 versus the distance from communities of 40,000 or more, if the amendments are attached to this bill, the criteria of counties 75,000 and under would be eliminated altogether, and the eligibility would be strictly based on distance from a community of 40,000 or more. As you can see by the map, what the amendment does, changing from a community of 30,000 to a community of 40,000, is that McMinnville is between 30,000 and 40,000, and so the circle with one red town close to McMinnville, that gets added, and then Grants Pass is the other community that's just slightly above 30,000.
Thank you. I could you help me remember? I know we talked about this the last time. The communities that currently individuals receive that tax credit are where? And this is an expansion of an existing tax credit.
Correct. Chair Cowan, the criteria are currently that the volunteer must be working for an agency that's located in a community at least 25 miles from a town of 30,000 and more.
Okay.
So we
on the map, there isn't any real way to depict where, what communities are currently eligible then?
That's true. Another way to look at it is the only ones that are not, the ones that are in the gray circles are the communities that are not eligible, and every other community is.
Thank you. That helps. I just couldn't quite remember, and I didn't want to jump to that conclusion. Are there any other questions for Scott at this particular point? Representative Biker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going through this, so basically everything outside of the gray circle would be included if the town's under 30,000. To make sure I'm...
Chair Cowan, Representative Widener, that's correct. And if the dash 3 amendments were attached, then it would be communities over 40,000. So the towns that are highlighted in red would be added to the program. So as you can see, it's a fairly minimal addition to the program. It's relatively small. It's just the towns in red that would be added.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Follow-up.
To me, if we were going to do this, I mean, I think we should have a bill that would address volunteer firefighters in small communities of a town size or something like that, because I mean, I'm just going through looking at a lot of these towns that are small, and they're strictly all volunteer firefighters, and we're excluding them. And that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So to me, we're playing favorites and picking and choosing who we want in and who we don't. So, because you got Timber, which is small, Scappoose, Yamhill, Carlton, Perrydale. I mean, Perrydale, Amity, Turner, Sublimity, those are all really small towns that rely on volunteers as well. So I think we need to look at a bill that would address all volunteers and not single out people off a location.
Thank you. Representative Boone?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott, maybe you have the answer to how that map was derived. Didn't it have something to do with the rural physicians credit?
Chair Cowan, Representative Boone, that's correct. When the program was first developed, it was done in a way to make the financial impact as small as possible. And so even though the other programs that we administer in our office are based on criteria of 10 miles from a community of 40,000, this program was made 25 in order to reduce the revenue impact.
Follow up? Just for the record, I agree with Representative Widener that all volunteer firefighters and EMT personnel should be allowed to have this tax credit.
There is very likely to be a work group appointed who may be calling on you for some expertise.
Be more than happy to serve on that work group.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Scott? Thank you. Jody Weiser?
Do you start that with Eskimo and bring it down this way?
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser, and I'm representing myself rather than Tax Fairness Oregon at this moment because we haven't discussed this as a group. This is the hardest testimony of the year so far for me because obviously these volunteers are doing absolutely essential work. But I remember when the bill passed a couple sessions ago, and I thought this is a bad road to start down. We use tax credits rather than making a decision to fund something that we think is important too often in this building. I think it's clear that it's expensive. I actually paid for my own child to get this kind of training, so I know it's expensive to get this training. And I think it would make far better public policy if we would make sure that training for these services were paid for by the public. And we stop with that. I don't think that it's appropriate for volunteers to become funded, and that is what a tax credit for being a volunteer does. I mean, I could ask somebody to submit a bill that gets me a tax credit for being a volunteer down here all the time. There aren't too many, volunteer people in this building, and I don't think we want to go that way. And yet, when I saw it pass a few years ago, I thought, this is going to expand and expand and expand, and pretty soon we will be giving tax credits for people who work at the local library. Because they do important stuff, too. We want libraries, and pretty soon it's possible that in many of our counties there won't be libraries unless they're taken care of by volunteers. But I think volunteers do what their hearts lead them to do, and that volunteerism should be something that they do out of their heart rather than because they get a tax credit. I do think that training people for these jobs and retraining them as they need to be retrained makes perfect sense, and we should find a place in our budget to pay for that kind of thing rather than use tax credits. We're complicating the tax code, which is already terribly complicated. We're asking ourselves to make decisions outside of ways and means instead of within ways and means, and that's really the appropriate way for this body to be making decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Boone?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought I'd made it clear in my testimony that this is not, firefighters and EMS workers are not the same as volunteers for a library, because library volunteers traditionally do not put out around $1,000 or more dollars of their own, out of their pocket to do that volunteer work. So that, I'd like to just make that clear on the record.
Right.
And continue to say that the amount of money being discussed today as a tax credit falls far less than what the true training costs would be. And that's just the training. So.
Right. Yes, but there are a number of kind of volunteer activities where you, like if you want to work on a crisis line, you need a week's worth of training. There's other places that this could end up going, and it's I don't think it's the way we should make law. That's all.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2460 and reopen the House Bill, the public hearing on House Bill 3087. for the purpose of seeing if there's anybody else who would like to testify on 3087, like maybe someone from the special districts who could talk to us a little bit about numbers, maybe. But I wouldn't want to force them. Well, I stalled to get an answer to my question here.
Certainly.
Madam Chair,
members of the committee, for the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. So I have this illness that burns numbers into the back of my head when I've worked really hard on bills. So House Bill 2420, the cancer presumption bill, was, as you know, a very heavily negotiated bill. And so I believe the last recollection that I have was, according to the State Fire Marshal's Office, there are 7,333 volunteer firefighters in the state of Oregon and 3,174 paid firefighters in the state of Oregon. I could
Not
verify
bad.
That statistic, but it's some illness that I was born with. And I apologize.
I'm sorry about that, but
I know.
Thank you for
it's fun balancing my checkbook. That's all I'll say.
Well, thank you for participating with us today.
Where does your checkbook currently stand?
I didn't recognize that question, Representative. Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on either of these two bills? Okay. I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3087 and ask that we do put together a work group that would involve the primary sponsors of each of those bills, Representative Chris Edwards and Representative Ron Maurer, and this committee of Representatives Boone, Widener, and Freeman would be willing to participate in that. That would be terrific. I'm sure that Scott Ekblad will help out as well. And let's see if we can bring something that makes sense and for the two of them. Okay. Did we get that?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3097. Hoping I didn't miss anybody on the previous one. Representative Matthews.
I may begin, Madam Chair.
You may. That's, I don't know why I have a block. I'm sorry about that.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3097. Would allow applicants for certification as the EMT or first responders to substitute the certification for the National Registry of Emergency Medical Technicians in lieu of the training course approved by the Oregon Department of Human Services, Emergency Medical Services. It specifically removes the minimum requirement of an associate's degree requirement for paramedics. It provides flexibility for agencies investigating EMTs that may or may not be trained to the current standards in place. It allows individuals to apply and be accepted to become state EMT with only the national registry. And I do have an error there. It says not the state registry. So it's just with only the national registry, period. And there are no amendments at the very time. And this has a no revenue impact. But and I don't have anything on fiscal for you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Matthews.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Matthews. I'm state representative of House District 50, which is Gresham. The bill as described in summary is not really the bill that we're seeking. We're going to be assembling a work session. I want to make that clear first off. And really the true intent of this bill is it's about everything we've heard so far, even in today's committee. It's recruitment and retention. It's the ability for our rural communities to get good, solid EMT, basic, intermediate, and paramedics. It's to simplify the reciprocity issues of out-of-state medics transferring into Oregon. But I want to be clear that it was never intended to come out as in lieu of a state certification or to water down the integrity of EMS delivery service. You're going to hear testimony today from fire service professionals, Dr. Sani, I believe, who is EMS in trauma. He'll talk to you about the importance of the program as well. And I do think as a state, Oregon is one of only two states that has an associate's degree as a requirement for paramedics. In talking with those folks, we've had several conversations. They've explained that that was necessary to increase the service delivery of our EMS to our citizens. I agree with that. However, the point that I don't agree with is that a paramedic that might serve in Colorado, Idaho, or wherever else they might be, for X amount of years and transferring to Oregon should be forced to get a two-year degree if they could transition in with their National Registry paramedic into the state certification. I think your years of service should mean something. I think that, you know, what I'd like to see in the bill is that we deal with a couple issues. One is reciprocity, so years of service means something. Currently, there's a condition in the state certification that allows if you transfer from out of state, you have to get a two-year degree, but you're able to be a paramedic for, I believe it's 2 years, to get that degree. But it's very taxing on a family to work a 56-hour work week and also attend school just to simply meet a requirement that Oregon is one of only two states that has in place. I do respect the college programs. I believe they do a great job. But when you talk about EMS delivery, you can't just think about career departments. You have to think about our rural communities. You have to think about what it's going to be for these folks to become paramedics and retain their paramedics. Rarely will people go to this kind of training for free. And will they continue to volunteer in that community as a medic when they can make money doing it elsewhere? The other thing that this bill is going to do, and I say going to because I'm very convinced that we will end up with a solid bill with all stakeholders involved. We will have our volunteer firefighters represented, volunteer service deliverers, our ambulance drivers. We'll have our EMS professionals in the fire service community, and we'll have some folks from Dr. Sani's office at DHS as well come to the table to get a bill that we can work with. And one of the real key driving forces behind this for me was the reintegration tactics for our military personnel. It might be a little selfish, but I'll tell you, I think that a lot of our military folks transition nicely into the fire service. It's set up as kind of a platoon and a squad. It's the way we deploy our service. It's training. It's the family atmosphere, the station house, the dorm type mentality. And I really think that it's a good fit for those folks. And so a big part of this puzzle in talking with Paul Evans, Governor's Policy Advisor for Military Affairs, is that what we want to do, too, is take a look at the military, the training that they're getting in the military, and find a way to get that to transition to at least the National Registry EMT Basic. If we're able to do that in the state, when our military veterans return, they can start applying and get right to work and hopefully get jobs, you know, in the fire service. And again, I think it's a reintegration tactic for me in that I think it's a great fit for those folks that want to get jobs and serve in their community. And let's face it, I think this is before this committee because of it is service. And as I said earlier, I respect your years of service that you've had on the ambulances. I respect your years of service as a firefighter and what you do out there in EMS. And I think that anything we can do towards somehow simplifying that process without watering it down, and I want to be clear, I know there's a difference. We do not want to, I'm not looking to remove the two-year degree, which brought everybody out on me real quick. You'd have thought I was trying to put a limit on how many dogs you could have. I got so many emails. But the, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I apologize. But in reality, then that was fine because what it did was it enlightened me also. And I think the one thing that we have to be is open to discussion. And I've been open to that discussion. I understand how hard they've worked to get that bar raised to the point where it is. So I think you're going to hear some testimony today from some folks that really, they're in opposition to the bill as it was originally drafted, but that's not the bill that we're trying to move forward with. So I do appreciate their involvement, and we'll appreciate their involvement in the workforce, and hopefully in the end, we'll have a bill that we can look at that's going to help our folks with reciprocity issue from out of state, but also reintegration for our military veterans. And that was the goal all along.
Thank you. And I'm going to hold, unless there are burning questions for Representative Matthews. We have a couple of folks that were invited. The reason this is listed as invited testimony only is because I was aware that this bill needed to go back for some work. We just wanted to get it out there and kind of briefly get the issues on the record. And so we're going to keep it relatively succinct today. So thank you.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. And all the folks that you're going to hear from today, I think, all have vested interest in. I'm looking forward to hearing what they have to say, but also working with them throughout the process. So thanks for having me. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Dr. It's Ratu Sani, is that right? Or close somewhere. And Greg Lander, please. And Mark.
Steve.
Mark Stevens, I didn't have him on my list, but we'll let you join us. I would like to keep this fairly brief because we have an informational hearing that these folks are waiting for as well. So if we could just get the kind of the key issues out there, and then we'll let you work with this other guy to get it straightened out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ritu Sani. I'm the medical director of the EMS and trauma system. I'm part of the new management team that took over in about the last 18 months as a result of a federal review of the EMS system. I have written testimony, which I think most of you have already seen, and I won't go over that, especially given Representative Matthews' testimony. I just want to say that we are certainly looking forward to and willing to work with Representative Matthews and actually share his concerns about reciprocity. The only things that I want to add to what Representative Matthews said and that is in our testimony is, number one, the associate's degree requirement, just some background on that. That was in 1999, that was enacted. Primarily, well, not primarily, but one of the factors was that the paramedic education program was becoming a longer program that would take roughly 2 years. And so, in addition, and Greg, I assume, will testify regarding the goals of professionalism and building the profession. That requirement was reviewed as part of our rules revision in the last couple of years, and a number of stakeholders came out, and at that particular time, it was felt that it was beneficial, and that stayed in the rules. You have some addenda included in the testimony, and one of the addendum two, is our national pass rate for the National Registry Examination at the paramedic level. And I would just say that we typically are first or second in the country for states that use that, and I think it's a direct result of our educational system. We actually, we average on our first time through for our individuals higher than the national pass rate for six times through. You have six opportunities to pass. The national average is 84%. We average that on person's first attempt. So we felt that it served well and that is why it remained. The other piece that I wanted to talk about for about another minute has to do with reciprocity, and that's Addenda 3. And we strongly agree with Representative Matthews that that is a key component of our future in EMS. And in the last year and a half since we've made a lot of strides in improving the reciprocity process. It used to take 2 to 3 months to get somebody reciprocity. We now can turn somebody actually from a military discharge around in 1 to 2 days. We can turn most people around in reciprocity in 2 to 3 weeks. So it's a significant improvement. And then finally, regarding military integration, I would just point out that primarily the U.S. Army, but all of the military branches, a combat medic is already typically nationally registered as an EMT basic, and our reciprocity rules allow that to basically be a demonstration of competency. So with those quick updates, and again, I look forward to working with Representative Matthews, I would take any questions. Thank you very much, Chair Cowan.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate this summary and the information that we have here. We'll look forward to further work on this one. Mark or Greg, who wants to go first here?
Go ahead.
And again, I'm going to ask you to keep it fairly succinct since we're going to be working with a different bill when we come out.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair and Representatives, for the record, my name is Mark Stevens. I'm the Vice President of the Oregon Fire Medical Administrators Association, also representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association today on the matter. The Fire Chiefs and OFMAA are on record as supporting and have been supporting the most recent AA requirement as we revised it and went into effect in the last OAR change. Very concerned about portability. Our private ambulance partners have been as well in the past. With this latest change, people can come in and get the provisional paramedic or their EMT and be able to go to work right away. So that was one of the things we were after. The other was they can then have up to 2 years to achieve about 1 year of work to achieve the associate degree of any of their choice. It doesn't have to be a specific degree. And the reason we like that is so people can write better, so they can calculate medications, they can communicate better critical thinking skills at the paramedic level. The EMT basics come in as a turnkey deal, as Dr. Sani said, and we encourage that. I look forward to in the work session see what we can do with the military to maybe have them come out with that credential and make it quicker to get into Oregon. I had just a couple attachments that you can look at. One thing we we wanted to do. I saw in the state newsletter the number of paramedics, this graph that was in my handout. I applied it, the numbers to a graph, and it surprised me to see we'd had a 43% increase in paramedics over the last 10 years. So they're not having trouble coming in, and it's gotten better. We know anecdotally some cases that are much better now with the latest OAR change as well. That's some background information that we are getting paramedics, and it's just a matter of capturing those as employers. Our latest hiring process at my day job, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, had 995 qualified applicants, and 64 of those got veterans preference points, and they're from all over the country. I saw at least half the states, people trying to get in. And if they've got their national registry, we can put them to work very quickly right after the academy. So we look forward to working with the group and the team toward some of those same goals. Thanks.
Great. Sounds like we can get some good coordination with the other bill as well about the National Guard. So.
Yeah.
Greg.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Lander. I'm representing the Oregon EMS or EMT Consortium, which is actually a group that represents all of the schools that teach EMT and paramedic classes. I've been involved for too many years maybe, but a lot of years in EMS in Oregon, a lot of different levels, and my testimony there you have, I'll speak to some of that, and just to make this a little briefer, obviously there was some very strong concern about the bill as it originally came forward. We have met with Representative Matthews, and what he's attempting to do and everything, obviously it didn't get represented too well with the bill. And I think that, like I said, just to make this fairly short, these two have pretty much talked to a lot of my points. But we are very interested in education. We don't want to downplay that. We don't want to limit what a patient or what a person is going to get out there that calls 911. We don't want to water that down. They need to be able to look up and know that the person there to take care of them is trained to the best of their ability. So we also want to maintain the level of response, and if we have issues with people coming in, then we need to talk to that, look to that, and do that. And I'm very willing to sit on a committee and our work group and also participate with that. And that's good enough for now.
Well, I appreciate that. Unless there are any burning questions here, I'm going to ask the three of you to work with Representative Matthews to.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we'll do that. Andy Darkins, who's my legislative aide, has been helping out greatly, and you've been in communication with him. We'll put a work session together. I think, in fact, he's probably going to make his way down and try to take a glance at the calendars a few weeks in advance and see when we can set you up. But I appreciate you being here today, and thanks again for not overreacting to what didn't meet our intended target, and working with the process. I think in the end we'll have something we can come forward with, and it'll be pretty easy for folks to pass through. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your time here. And we also have another volunteer for the previous work group. Genoa Ingram from Special Districts will work with the other work group on the EMT credit. So thank you for volunteering. With that, I will close. I should have done this first. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3097. And we now have a informational update on 911 services, and here he comes. Committee, for your understanding, the reason I held 2167 and will determine later whether or not we need to go to a work group is part of this overall view of where we are with 911 and the number of public safety answering points that we currently have and how they function, and is there a reason to continue some conversation around potential consolidations, and if in that process there were costs involved, how might we meet them? And so that's part of the overall presentation that Mr. Murphy is going to make today, and I'm holding the other bill in case we need it as a vehicle for that conversation. So, Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Murphy, Director of Oregon Emergency Management, a division of the Oregon Military Department.
Yes.
The packet that's being handed out to you today is a document that is produced by the Association of Public Communications Officials and the National Emergency Number Association, which are the two organizations that represent our public safety answering points in the state of Oregon, and I will use their document to just cover some brief items. I am not going to drill down very deep and go through all of this. There's some history of the 911 system in Oregon, but I want to just cover a few items that can lead us into further conversation, and we can provide you much more detail if you so desire. As you are aware, the 911 system really is a overall essential component of the public safety system and really the entry point when danger, disasters, car wrecks, any number of things come into our public safety system to support the citizens and visitors to the state of Oregon. In Oregon's history, we really began in the early 80s with the legislature approving the authorization for this and the tax to include a sunset date, which has always been there and is part of the review process to look at this. And the current sunset date is January 1st, 2014, and that has been part of the process each time we go through legislation to review the entire program and the taxing of the 911. It originally started out as percentages, and then as time grew and as technology changed, the legislature approved it to be 75 cents instead of a percentage, which it is currently today, and that 75 cents is imposed on each circuit, wireline and wireless, capable of accessing 911 services. But it does not include, as technology has progressed in our society, things as prepaid phones like you see in stores like the track phone. And I think most of you are well aware our society today has an insatiable appetite for new technology and different levels of the ability to do everything from any kind of device. And interestingly, prepaid phones, you know, when you read the industry magazines and talk to the industry, it's the fastest growing segment of our consumer system in phones in the nation. Difficult to locate these phones. It's difficult to identify who actually owns the phone. And so it's interesting as we progress through technology, and I think we've mentioned in the past, and I think you're all well aware that the technology just continually amazes us as what you can do, and will continue, I'm quite sure, to evolve into things that none of us have even thought of yet that will eventually be able to access 911. In the packet that I handed out for you for your reference, the second page, which is a chart with some circles on it, I will primarily address that. The rest of it is for your reading pleasure, some legislative activity, some actual history of the 911 program since 1973, and then also a map of each county in Oregon showing where the public safety answering points are located. And then right below that is a small number, 6.20 or whatever the case may be. And those, as of this report, the 2008 budget report, show the number of full-time equivalents that are located in that public safety answering point. And of course, those numbers fluctuate, obviously. Going over the chart, as you look at it, you can see the very top circle in the black area shows 58% of the funds are distributed out to the public safety answering points. And of that money, 30% of that the 911 tax goes to their operating costs. 70% of that is then funded through different mechanisms in the jurisdictions that from revenue fees, user fees, whatever the case may be. And so 70% of their operating costs are funded by themselves. And each jurisdiction and public safety answering point has a users board or some sort of oversight organization that works with the jurisdictions and how the manage of the public safety answering point goes. As you move to the right of the circle, as you look at it, you see the 4% to the Office of Emergency Management. That references back the earlier bill we talked about. That is for use by my office for the administration of the program, and we also fund telecommunications standards and training with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, where individuals go for training on the 911 communicators. We also have a small percentage for an equipment replacement account for different projects or unusual projects. As we go around the circle, we have 0.5% to the Department of Revenue to help fund their collection of the 75 cents from the telephone companies, so that helps pay for their efforts. And then the rest of the light gray circle, 35%, goes to the enhanced 911 sub-account. Over time, as you, if you read in the history of this paper, the 911 community, especially with the advent of cell phones, location technologies, we get into the programs of what you'll see or you'll hear the terminology E911. And that's really about the future, the current future that we're in. We've been working on this for many years. To have the ability to locate the person making the call and having that information. And as you follow the arrow down there, you can see how the money is distributed to all the different types of equipment, software, mapping, data, telephone network equipment, and maintenance, that type of thing, how that money is distributed out. To the public safety answering points to be able to meet the continuing and ongoing requirements of enhanced 911. As we move into the future, the next new acronym that the world has come up with is Next Generation 911. And that's really dealing with what we're going to have to deal with the new future of technology and the ability to dial 911, like I mentioned earlier, from any device. The most prevalent that is out there right now is dealing with voice over the internet protocol. Clearly a growing avenue for especially the younger generation, but even the more mature generation that is learning the benefits and dealing with how you can apply many different services to include calling 911 over the internet. These will, as many years ago, presented challenges to the public safety answering points when we were just dealing with location technology of a cell phone. We will have many new and different types of challenges with the next generation 911 that will cause us to relook at how different multimedia applications and data capabilities are put in place in a public safety answering point, which will undoubtedly mean different types of computer software, different types of hardware to be able to deal with all of these new emerging technologies. As I mentioned earlier, technology grows fast, and we have to grow with it as quick as we can to be able to address the equipment, software, training issues, and also look at the different things that are coming. Public safety answering points not only will receive a 911 call, but they'll receive a photograph from a cell phone or a PDA or a laptop. And so people have chose to start sending more and more different types of information. I'm sure 911 centers, in fact, I know they get text messaging, different things. It's just the way the world communicates today. So a lot of these things really are part of our society and have been going on for a while. The Virginia Tech shooting that happened, most all of that information that came in, the 911 assuming that came through students in closets texting to 911. So it's the world we live in, and the younger generation, any of us that have any kids, you know, my son and daughter won't call me, they'll text me, and it's just the way it is. And so I'm sure that that's how they have learned to communicate, and our future generations will do the same. I think, as I've just briefly mentioned, as we move forward into the public safety answering point, the challenges of any new technologies will be understanding them, having the proper standards, the new technologies that we'll have to figure out and how they fit into each area of our state and to deal with. The networks must be designed, working with the telephone industry, wireless and wireline, and testing this and designing the proper thing that will serve our citizens and the visitors to the state in the proper way. So I think I will leave it at that point. I will just open the conversation. As Representative Cowan mentioned, the Association of Public Communications Officials and the National Emergency Number Association here in Oregon have formed a consolidation task force, and it is in their strategic plan, which is a brand new plan just written for 2009 through 2013. We're having our first meeting this coming Thursday at my office, and they have sent out a questionnaire to all the public safety answering points, trying to really take a hard look at what efficiencies are out there that we can take advantage of. Numerous organizations already in the public safety answering arena are looking at that. Clatsop County, Representative Boone and Seaside and Astoria are looking at how they might be able to consolidate. Jackson County, their two public safety answering points. So it is on their mind. It is something that I think they know is the right thing to do, and they know their efficiencies, but we need to do it carefully, cautiously, and with the thought in mind that we can never jeopardize the service to what the citizens of this state expect.
Thank
Chair
you.
Cowan.
This is interesting information, and the map is very helpful as well. Representative Freeman, did you have a question?
Just really quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. Back on your funding page with all the circles,
yes.
Which section of the pie was the recent money used that was swept and taken out of 911 fund? Do you remember?
I'm going to hope somebody behind me can answer. Chair Cowan, Representative Freeman, I do not know exactly where that money was taken from.
Yeah, I'm sure it was the 911 enhanced 911 sub-account. It was not out of the regular operating funds. It was somewhere in that right-hand gray
within those three pieces there?
But okay. Within those three, I don't know that it was broken out.
Madam Chair, Representative.
General Caldwell.
For the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Military Department. I do know where it came from.
Oh, I'm sure you do.
It came out of it did come out of the enhanced account, and that account had roughly $7.5 million in it that had not been it had been earmarked, but it had not been we didn't have the limitation to spend that money, so it was sitting there earmarked for projects, but no ability to put it out to do that. So that's where it came from. $3.1 million came out of that account. $500,000 came out of the equipment replacement account, which is a statutory limitation on it to be, it can only grow to $500,000. And so that totaled to 3.6.
So to clarify that, are you saying then that the equipment replacement subaccount is now empty? Or it can grow back to $500,000.
Yes, ma'am. It can grow back. It will grow back by statute to $500,000.
Okay. Thank you. Does that answer your question? Well, not really, because
of the breakdown. Well, it's in percentages. I was wondering what percentage of the money collected, but we can do this later. I know that's a lot of numbers to ask.
That account basically comes up to around $30 million biennium.
Okay. So and then, 7.5 out of $30 million. Okay.
Correct. So that 3.1 came out of that account that's typically around $30
million.
Thank you. Representative Booth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how much of that money was taken out of what was earmarked for Owen?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, explain your earmark. I mean, the 0709?
Planned for.
Or are you talking the $8.1 million that the governor's recommended budget had?
The sweep was for 0709.
Correct.
So the 3.1 plus the 500,000 taken out of that,
correct,
that circle for the 0709 was,
correct,
is any plan to be taken out of that next budget? Our next budget would come out of Owen.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, don't know of any current plans by Legislative Fiscal Office to do that. They haven't shared those with us if they do intend to do that, nor has our subcommittee. We've presented before the subcommittee, but there's been no feedback as to how they want to shape the 0911 budget at this point.
It's premature, I think, that particular question. I don't think those decisions have been made.
Well, I know, but I wanted to clarify that was just on that one too.
Yeah.
So, and follow up. I'm confused because I thought $7 million was taken out. Was it only three? And
no, it was 3.1.
Three point six total.
Yeah, 3.6 with that.
3.1 out of one, 500,000 out of the other.
Okay.
Of a $30 million fund total.
Roughly 28. Depends on the collection, but it's going to be close to 30.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Okay. The brief conversation that has taken place and I think has generated a great deal of interest, hence the number of people in this room, is the need to, if there were going to be progressive discussions on the potential for some degree of consolidation of PSAPs. In the past, when that's happened, there's been a cost associated with that, and there hasn't been a source of funding to cover that cost. So there was some initial conversation about whether or not in some way something should be set aside for that. I think this is very interesting, the additional document we have here that talks about the strategic planning that's taking place, and it might be a bit premature to be moving forward. Your thoughts on
Madam
that?
Chair, I think it's premature because we don't have all of our facts and figures. One thing the document that does tell you, when we started out 911 in Oregon, we had almost 300 public safety answering points. And on their own volition and have reduced down in size over the years down to the 50 that we're currently at. And we've gone through studies before on this issue of consolidation. And I would think at this point in time we really truly do not have our facts and figures in such a manner that would tell us how much it would cost. There's no doubt there will be some cost. One of the things that I think will be indicative of this consolidation task force that meets is trying to be able to meaningfully capture what the issues are, how much it will cost, keeping in mind that we're racing against the clock of technology. So hopefully that the decisions that are recommended, you know, are not cheating us out of the future, if you may, you know, on how we deal with the new technologies.
I might just add, Madam Chair, if you don't mind, is that I concur with that at this particular moment, but I do believe that we need to make sure that we have a vehicle at some point, whether it be, you know, in the session in February, if there is one, or as this committee forms their thought process. It would be unfortunate in some cases were for a lack of a little bit of money that we couldn't get consolidation, and that's a real issue, I think, at the local level, where there may be $100,000 or a couple of $100,000 that needs to be put into infrastructure or something to make it happen, and they simply don't have that money, and so therefore they end up caught between a rock and a hard place. And I think we need to make sure that we have some flexibility in some of these funds. Is how do we get there? I don't know. I think we let the group, as Ken indicated, work through that, come up with their thoughts, because they deal with it every day. They live at the local level, and they'll probably be able to give us much better idea than what we could dream up here. But I think it's real important that we provide some sort of mechanism to allow that kind of grant process to occur at that level, so they do have those resources, so they're not held up because of it.
I can appreciate that. Any other questions? I'm going to open this in case there's anyone else who has some thoughts that we'd like to throw in. I can tell you that from the information that you've presented and what I've heard here today, I would strongly encourage that you have conversation with the ongoing work that's going on within the community, as you said, those with the expertise, and talk about what the needs might be and any potential discussion that we could have. But at this point, I do think it would be premature to try to decide where that might be coming from at this particular point in time. So I think this is an excellent update. I appreciate you bringing it to us.
Okay. Thank you.
I know there's a lot of interested parties in the audience today, so if there's anyone who would like to add to this discussion, I would certainly entertain that at this point. Seeing none, I would we will close the informational hearing, and I would like to reopen open a work session on House Bill 2167, for which at this point we have no amendments before us, and it seems to be essentially a housekeeping mechanism to streamline the process in how the accounts are used. And if the committee is ready for a motion, I would entertain one.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we move House Bill 2167 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. With a subsequent referral
To Ways and Means.
I'm
sorry.
I'm really going to start reading this, too. Okay.
That was
we have a motion before us to move House Bill 2167 forward with the aforementioned referral to Ways and Means. Debbie?
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Riley?
Excused.
Aye.
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 Aye. Thank you. That House Bill 2167 is moved forward to Ways and Means. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2167 and close this meeting of the Veterans and Emergency Services. Thank you all.
Yep.